socializing, the whys, and the changing ways we do it.
To say that people are addicted to Facebook is to say we're addicted to other human beings. Of course we are.
Bonding over Facebook, what we can learn from worms, and the oral history of children's games. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51% The Women's Perspective. Are you an introvert or an extrovert? A wallflower or the life of the party? What determines how social we are? Dr. Cornelia Bargman of Rockefeller University studies how biology, our genes, and the environment we live in can affect the way we act. She's especially interested in understanding social behaviors. Believe it or not, she studies worms to examine the underlying biology that can switch an individual from being a loner to a party animal, and back again.
The main project in my lab is to understand social behavior. We're humans, we're a social species. I'm talking to you. The reason that I can talk is that someone taught me language. The reason that I move through the world is that I interact with other people. And humans are the most successful species on Earth because we communicate and cooperate so effectively with each other. And other animals cooperate and communicate with each other too. And part of behavior is related to the interactions that animals have with each other. A really basic kind of interaction that lots of animals have with each other has to do with reproduction. How do you find a mate? How do you take care of your offspring? How do you raise them? But that even aside from mating, a lot of animals spend part of their lives in association with other animals. So you might see a school of fish or a flock of birds or a herd of sheep. And they recognize each other, they can cooperate together. So you see animals that are cooperating to hunt or cooperating to defend themselves against a predator. And they change those behaviors based on learning. They can sometimes learn about particular individuals. And our hypothesis, our theory about what's going on, is that there is an underlying biology that helps animals to recognize other individuals in the same species, and that helps to organize their behavior around those other individuals.
So how are you planning on getting to this underlying biology?
The trick that we use is to try to use the simplest animal to answer a question that we can. And that's one of the big tricks of biology, is how can I simplify this complex problem? I can't understand the genes that allow humans to live in cities. I can't necessarily even understand the genes that allow honeybees to form a complex hive. But if I can work with a really simple animal, I can try and understand the basic logic that helps simple behaviors develop and that helps simple animals associate with each other. And then maybe I'll have some of the building blocks that are used to generate more complex behaviors. Okay. So in my lab, we study an incredibly simple animal. It's called Caenorhabditis elegans. It's a tiny worm. It's the size of a comma on a printed page. And you might find it in an orchard in rotting apples, or you might find it in your garden in a compost heap eating bacteria. And if you found one, you might find more, because they like to hang out together. And you often find them in these little groups where they've separated off from the other worms, and they're feeding together and moving around together. And so we can ask, looking at this very simple worm, what is it that makes them recognize each other? Why is it that they're together some of the time and separate some other times? Mm-hmm. What genes allow them to do this recognition and this behavior? What does the behavior do for them? Because C. elegans, which is its short name instead of Caenorhabditis elegans, because it's very small, it's easy to grow in the lab. So I could have a little dish of C. elegans in the lab that would be the size of a saucer for a teacup. That might have 10,000 worms on it. We can get a lot of them. We can study them in different ways. We can manipulate their genes to change their genes. They're transparent, so we can actually look into their brains, mm-hmm. and we can see what their brain cells are doing while they're thinking and while they're sensing each other. And in our studies, we discovered not only that worms can detect each other and can form these social groups, but that different worms are different in their desire to form these social groups. Some worms are very sociable, that given a choice, they will always be with other worms and will spend very little time alone. Whereas other worms are more solitary, and given a choice, they'll actually be off on their own a lot, although occasionally they'll join a social group and then they'll separate off again. Right away, we can tell not only that worms have these behaviors, but different worms differ in these behaviors. We can ask something about, well, what makes a worm kind of a party worm, and what makes a worm more of a kind of thoughtful loner?
What have you found out so far?
Well, what we found out is that there are both genes and environmental conditions that determine whether animals want to be with each other or want to be separate. So, for example, animals prefer to be in social groups when they're under stress. We know different ways in which being in the social group actually helps them to cope with those stresses. They can make their environment better so that they're more successful. In addition, we found certain kinds of genes that change the way their nervous systems work that cause them to respond differently to one another. And these genes make proteins inside the brain that allow nerve cells to communicate with each other. The kind of proteins they make are called neuropeptide receptors. They're molecules that sit on the surface of one nerve cell and that gets information from another nerve cell that's being transmitted through the nervous system. And we think that these neuropeptide receptors are at different levels of activity in animals that prefer to be alone and then animals that prefer to be together.
How are these neuropeptide receptors acting and changing the behavior?
A human brain has billions of neurons that are connected to each other by trillions of connections. A worm brain is much simpler. There are 300 neurons, and they're connected to each other by thousands of connections. Now, you might think that all those neurons are wired up the same way all the time, but it's not true. Your brain works in different ways under different circumstances, and everyone knows that. Everyone knows that when you're hungry, you act a little different from how you act when you've just eaten, or when you're tired, you process information different from when you have a lot of energy. And what we think these neuropeptide receptors are doing are helping the brain to know which of these different kinds of states it's in so that it can function differently under different circumstances. And neuropeptides and neuropeptide receptors are one of the sets of molecules that are present in the brain. There are many different ones, and we think that they can communicate different kinds of information to the brain that's important in humans, not just in worms. They're important in regulating sleep, for example. They're important in regulating hunger and appetite. They're important in regulating pain and regulation of pain. So these are all conditions, long-lasting changes in your behavior might happen when you're hungry, when you're not hungry, when you're stressed, when you're not stressed. All of these are peptide-regulated changes that help your brain to process information differently depending on what your own needs are.
And what's the next step?
The next step, we're always doing two things as scientists. One thing that we do is to go deeper, and the other question we do is to try and go higher and to think big. So we always have a question like, how does this really work? And that makes us go deeper. We try and understand how the nerve cells turn themselves on and off, right, how they change their activity. And then the other question we have is how to go higher. Do we see systems like this in other animals? Are there other signals that are also important for regulating social behaviors? When social behaviors are changed by experience, does this system change or does a different system change? So we can kind of build out, just because we have one gene, it's just like having a foot in the door of the biology. Right. And we try and build out from one piece of understanding to a much bigger understanding of what a brain is and how an animal works.
I see. So that's a great example of how scientists actually work. Well, Corey, I'd love to know how you even got into science.
When I try and think about the first experience that really made me love science, it was when I was in the eighth grade, and my eighth grade friends and I were taking an earth science class, and our earth science teacher told us that sodium would burn when you put it in water. Mm-hmm. And we were so excited by this that we stole all the sodium from the Earth Science Lab and flushed it down a toilet, which exploded.
Oh, no.
And I think if more people blew things up, there would be more scientists today.
Should add it to the curriculum, you're saying?
But that's just a way of saying that I always loved the lab. Mm-hmm. When you're a scientist, you're not sitting around reading books, you're doing things. You're finding out how biology works. You're finding out how chemistry works. You're not just reading about it. You're actually putting chemicals together and seeing new chemicals form, seeing reactions occur, seeing things blow up. It's the lab itself and watching things happen that's exciting to me. And that's true. If you like to cook, you're almost halfway a chemist already.
Right, right.
You know, you're thinking about how these things mix together, how they're different after you heat them up or cool them down. If you like animals, you're halfway to being a biologist or a neuroscientist already. You know, if you watch birds and kind of see how the different birds behave or sync to each other, you're already becoming sort of interested in the behavior and the biology that underlie those. And I think it's a very immediate way of interacting with the world to be a scientist.
This interview has been a production of Carry the One Radio, recorded in San Francisco, California. Make sure to visit www.carrytheoneradio.com.
Dr. Cornelia Bargman is a professor at the Rockefeller University and an investigator of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. She is also leading President Obama's initiative to map the human brain. This interview comes to us courtesy of Carry the One Radio. Coming up, is there room for Facebook in a relationship? And the oral history of Miss Mary Mack. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1287. In the information age, it seems the art of communication is changing forever. Commentator Minda Zetlin reflects on what A Quiet Night Together has become now that Facebook has joined the family.
It had been a wearying day. My husband and I had driven more than 4 hours from our home in upstate New York to rural Vermont. We were visiting my mother and stepfather, my 90-year-old mother, in her 15th year with Alzheimer's, seemed barely present. It was holiday time, and the next few days would require many more hours of driving as we made the family rounds. But for now, we were sprawled in a large room in a funky World War I era hotel. Arrayed between us were wine, bread, and the finest cheeses the local general store could muster. And there was Bill, on his side of the bed, gazing lovingly at his smartphone, into the eyes of Facebook. At random intervals, he'd pipe up with reports. His friend Karen sent us holiday wishes. His sister in California was cooking Christmas dinner. Some heartwarming bit of news had caught his attention. One item stood out. In an elementary school, students only got participation credit for activities if their phones were stored face down on a special shelf. "I think that's a great idea," Bill said. I couldn't resist. "Do you think you should get participation credit for this evening?" I asked him. "Oh, but I thought we were just hanging out," he said. He sounded flustered and dismayed. I knew he didn't mean to neglect me. He thought we could sit together, I with my tablet, he with his smartphone. We would munch cheese while trading holiday greetings and news tidbits from Facebook and the web. That was his idea for making the best of things. But it wasn't mine. Am I weird for not liking Facebook? I know a billion people disagree with me. But most of it is updates from people I barely know telling me things I frankly don't care about. Then there's the constant barrage of requests, like a friend who never stops asking for favors. Like this page. Vote for this contestant. Sign this petition. Try out this game. I visit Facebook because I must, to keep up with our family, make contact with other writers, and promote my own work. I never go there for pleasure. Bill does, though. He used to spend the hour before lights out reading Facebook posts on his laptop by our bed. Things changed after I got him an Android phone for his birthday. Now he can check Facebook wherever he is, whenever he likes, and he does, 3 or 4 times a day. In between, he wanders the internet looking for interesting stories and factoids. When he finds them, he posts them to Facebook. So when psychologists in Norway created the first ever Facebook Addiction Scale to measure people's overuse of Facebook, you might think I'd be nodding in agreement, but I'm not. I think they're missing an important point. Bill uses Facebook more than I do because he reaches out more than I do, all the time, to everyone. He spent hours driving on tiny roads from pub to pub in Central Ireland looking for relatives he'd never met. He detoured again and again to the same little music store in New Jersey, hoping to catch a long-lost friend who sometimes taught guitar there. Facebook makes all this so much easier. My mother was born in the Philippines. Her father came from Belgium, and my aunts, uncles, and cousins are scattered everywhere. One cousin created a Facebook group for all of us, and now I know I have relatives from Toronto to Dubai. To say that people are addicted to Facebook is to say we're addicted to other human beings. Of course we are. We've lived in tribes since the beginning of the species. Keeping in contact is literally in our DNA. I may not have much patience for Facebook, but I still want news about the people I care about. Without Bill's constant monitoring, I would not have known that one dear friend was spending a week in Paris, or that another's beloved pug dog had abruptly died. We live in the country, far from most of our friends and family members. Without Bill and Facebook, I'd be much more isolated. That's why I told him there in the hotel to go ahead and stay on Facebook. I was tired and melancholy after the visit with Mom. I didn't feel much like talking, and there was little he could do to cheer me up. But he could be my conduit to the connected world. He could send greetings from both of us, while I curled up on my side of the bed with a book. A couple of weeks later, I attended a journalist's fellowship in Arizona. There was spotty cell phone coverage and brief breaks between sessions. I wanted to contact Bill during the day, but what to do? Texting him wasn't ideal. Sometimes he heard his phone, sometimes not. Then I had a flash of inspiration. I sent him a message via Facebook. He answered me right away.
Minda Zetlin is a columnist at Inc.com and the author or co-author of 5 books. This essay is adapted from her blog. You can find her at MindaZetlin.com. Communication isn't just about tweets and status updates. Sometimes it's about stories. Children have their own kind of oral history in the form of rhymes and hand-clapping games that are passed down from generation to generation. What they offer is continuity and a head start in literacy.
When it comes to DIY, doing it yourself doesn't have to mean doing it all by yourself. In fact, some of the most creative DIY projects are the kind that can only be accomplished when people work together. Oral history is a great example. It's passed down from person to person, generation to generation. The culture of children has its own oral traditions in the form of hand-clapping games. The rhymes may change a little with each generation, but they have some amazing staying power. Maybe it's because we start learning them at such a young age.
Patty cake, bake old man, bake me a cake as fast as you can.
This is Sophia Presnell. She's 3 years old.
Roll it, pat it, mark it with a B, put it in the oven. Baby and me.
Most children learn patty cake from their parents or teachers.
I want it from Mama.
When they get a little older, kids start to teach other kids more complex games.
Mama, Mama, can't you see what this baby's done to me? Took away my MTV. Now I'm watching Barney. Don't stop till your hands get red. Starting right now.
I visited the Boys and Girls Club in Northeast Portland, where I recorded this group of girls.
Hi, my name is Tajay.
My name is Kones, and I'm 11 years old.
My name is Jada.
My name is Deshauna.
My name is Demaya.
They were all between the ages of 9 and 11, and they knew a lot of hand-clapping rhymes. There was a group of high school girls there who said they'd outgrown these games, But when I asked them what they remembered, it wasn't long before they were giggling, singing, and clapping.
Shake, shake, shake to the rhythm of tape. We're gonna rock to the tree top all day long. Puffing and a puffing and a singing that song. All little birds on neighbor street. Let me hear the rock and roll, tweet, tweet, tweet. Rock and roll, tweet, 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 elite. Rock and roll, tweet, 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 elite. Mom's in the kitchen, bird and rice. Dad's in the corner, shooting at dice. Brothers in jail, ringing at bell. Sister, the curse of fruit cocktail. Rock and roll, tweet, 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 elite. Rock and roll, tweet, 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 elite.
When I asked the girls what makes them want to play these games, they all pretty much said the same thing.
When you super-de-duper bored and there's nothing else to do, you just break out some hand games.
Educator Karen Ellis says there's a lot more to it than that. She's the curator of the National Children's Folk Song Repository, which is part of her website, the Educational Cyber Playground. When she was a classroom teacher, she asked kids to show her their hand-clapping games.
And I rhythmically and melodically wrote all that information down and learned everything they taught me. And turned around at some point, and this was over a few years, at some point I turned around and started to use all of the information, all the poetry, for their reading curriculum. I managed to raise everybody's reading level a few years in a very, very short amount of time.
Karen has collected all kinds of teaching materials and studies about the link between hand games and child development. She's also created a place where people can preserve the songs and chants they remember from childhood.
One, two, three. Down by the banks of the hankety-pank, when the bullfrogs jump from bank to bank, with the eats, ops, loafs, ops, he's got the look with the big curve-plops.
You're out! No, you're out!
Most girls and a few boys play these games at some point in their lives. And they aren't something you just forget when you grow up. I got two women I know to participate in a little experiment. Stephanie Lawson and Alicia Sullivan are both in their late 20s, and they grew up on opposite sides of the country. They didn't know each other before they came into the studio, but they found they knew a lot of the same hand games.
Miss Susie had a steamboat. The steamboat had a bell.
Toot toot.
Sweet! Miss Susie went to heaven.
The... I think it skips the third one. In that.
Okay, it skips the third one.
The steamboat went to hello, operator. Please give me number 9. And if you disconnect me, I'll kick you from behind the refrigerator. There was a piece of glass. Miss Susie sat upon it and broke her little. Ask me no more questions and tell me no more lies. The boys are in the bathroom, zipping up their flies are in the meadow. Oh,
according to Karen Ellis, these games have their roots in 19th century Europe. Kids around the world continue to play hand-clapping games in English, Spanish, Creole, and other languages. And this cooperative cultural tradition has spread across geographic boundaries.
You can find a game song in St. Croix in the Virgin Islands, and you can find the same one in South Philly. And that connectedness, the physicality of it, just hitting your hands and hitting them in time and sharing all of that together is really how it stays alive. And it's organic. And that's why it's stayed intact for hundreds of years. Miss Mary Mack is everywhere, but that doesn't mean that it's this done exactly the same way everywhere.
You know what, this Miss Mary Mack, all dressed in black, and with silver buns, all down her back, that. She asks her mother, for 50 cents, to see the elephant jump over the...
If you want to visit Karen Ellis's Cyber Playground and add the rhymes you remember to the National Children's Folk Song Repository, there's a link on our website, destinationdiy.org.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again, or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.